Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, the cost of capital. It's a little run here with the numbers. The market was started out kind of had a sour period, but it began to show some life by the end, as you'll see. Now, the bears were still having their say, but as you will see here, the Dow was the only one that ended up down. The sour news was more for the largest companies. And then the S&P 500, as you see, actually recovered from some loss, bear activity in the middle of the day, and it's finishing up a little bit up. So the Dow is down a modest 0.13%, and then S&P 500 was up about a third of a percent, and then the NASDAQ got up almost a full percent. So there was some good news there, and crude, if you want some more good news, crude has slid. Does that mean lower prices at the gas pump? Probably not, but you know, we might hope for a little bit of ease up with the gas prices, but don't expect those prices, the oil prices, to stay down for very long. Going over here, and gold and silver not showing any life at all, down. The 10-year bond lost yield, which means the price was up. So investors were putting money into bonds, driving the price up and the yield down, and then they were also putting a little money into the stock market, too. However, if you look at the volume on the S&P 500, you can still see that we have really anemic volume. The day is going to finish about a third of the volume of a typical day over the last 52 weeks. That's the concern, is that the big dogs are staying on the sidelines, wait and see what's going to happen next with what's going on in the whole wide world. So that's the bad news there, is that that low volume means that there's a lot of resistance to sticking money out or capital out into the market right now. Here we go, the yield curve. Does not look friendly at all. You've got that notch, that 7-10-year inversion. It has made it from 2 basis points a week ago to the point where we are now, good grief, 6 basis points down. So it's not getting itself right. It's just getting itself even worse. So that points to the recession coming up. If we're going to have one, like I said, it won't be a horrible thing, but it will come 9 to 12 months, and it will be moderate, what we have of it. The Fed may cause that to happen more quickly, because they've signaled a more aggressive increase in interest rates to snuff out the inflation and the expectation of the inflation that is embedding in the markets right now. So that might cause the recession to be a little bit sooner than 9 months. We'll see, though. One way or the other. This topic this week is about the cost of capital. And it's an odd thing. Most people are pretty comfortable with the idea that debt has a cost. Now, when we say cost in finance, unlike accounting, we are usually talking about a percentage, a cost as a percentage. So the cost of debt, we would write as an R sub D, and it would be a percentage. Now, the easiest way to do that would be to say, okay, a corporation issues bonds. What's the coupon on its last bond that it's issued? Say it's an 8% subordinated, junior subordinated bond. Okay, 8%. That's the cost of debt. Probably not. We wouldn't want to use that. We would prefer to use the yield to maturity, because that is what the market currently thinks the debt cost should be. If the company were to go out and borrow more money right now, it would not pay that coupon on its last debt. It would pay the yield to maturity. So if the coupon is 8%, but the yield to maturity is 8.20%, the next time it goes out to borrow money, the market's saying 8.2% is the current what you should pay. So we would want to use the yield to maturity. A good thing about debt, though, from the corporation's perspective, is that the interest is tax deductible. So the after-tax cost of debt is the pre-tax cost of debt times 1 minus the corporate tax rate. This is very different from equity. You get to deduct, a corporation gets to deduct its cost of debt. It gets to deduct the cost of debt. So that makes it debt even cheaper. Debt is generally cheaper than equity for two reasons. The first reason it's cheaper than equity is because debt is safer than equity. The lenders to a corporation get the first claim on cash flow. The corporation has to pay the debt holders what's owed them this month or this year or whatever before it can pay any dividend to its shareholders. So the debt holders are in a less risky position, so they won't require as much as far as cost goes. And then there's this. The interest expense is tax deductible for a corporation. So that makes it even more attractive as far as cheapness goes. I'm trying to think. I know what I was going to tell you. Here's an interesting, and it's historical sidelight, but it's actually a now thing too. When federal income taxes were early on, back over a century ago or so, the top marginal tax rate for rich people, for companies, was 90%. I mean, if you even suggested that today, corporations and rich people would threaten to kill themselves. They would pay any amount of money to buy another Congress and another president and everything else to stop that. Well, the 90% eventually got to 70%. And then it slid over the years as more and more cries for tax cuts came around. And then it stabilized for a long time. Now, in my early time, it was 70%. But it was years ago. It was decades ago. It finally slid down to the top marginal tax bracket was 39%. That was it. And it stayed there for a long, long time. Then, in 2017, there was a massive tax cut. It was the deepest one in history for the wealthy and for corporations. It took the top bracket for corporations down to 21%. That's the highest. Of course, that was one of the reasons our budget deficits went insane and all of that, but it went clear down to 21%. So, interestingly, I've been beefing at the publishers because they're still listing 39% as the top marginal tax bracket. That's the one you put in for T for big corporations. It's 0.21, 21%. Now, notice an interesting odd thing about that, though. As the top marginal tax bracket goes down, that makes debt actually a more expensive source of capital. Because instead of like 8% times 1 minus 0.39, it's now 8% times 1 minus 0.21. So this actually works against the use of debt in capital structure. Also, interestingly enough, and you'll see this, I think it's next week or the week after that, You'll also see that, interestingly enough, as you reduce the top marginal tax bracket, it actually takes away a huge incentive for companies to do investments in new projects. Because you see, if you got a high tax rate, companies will do investments because then they don't have to pay tax on the investments. But if there's hardly any tax to pay anyway, why should they care? So back in the day, you had a high marginal tax rate. One of the specific reasons was because this makes companies do all kinds of investments in new projects, so they hire a lot of people just so they don't have to pay the high taxes. And now that's fizzled out a lot. We'll talk about that next time. But anyway, that's all there is to the cost of debt. If I say, well, the cost of debt is, oh, well, the yield to maturity is, or whatever, and all that, and the tax rate is, well, there's your after-tax cost of debt. So we've got one side of the cost of capital all done. And then comes the other side. Equity. And here's the odd thing about equity. The common person, even in my consulting, a lot of business people don't think of stock as having a cost. They don't think of ownership as a cost. They don't think of profit as a cost. They don't think of retained earnings as a cost. That's accounting. Sure that, no, they aren't. Their profit is profit. It's good. Well, in finance, we say that's a double-edged sword. The stock of a corporation is a cost to the corporation. The owners are a cost to the corporation. The retained earnings is a cost to the corporation. We don't seem to notice it at first, but over a period of time, it kind of comes through. You own a car. It's owned. You own it. Well, when I talk about cost of the car, you'd say, yeah, the gas and the maintenance. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the car itself is a cost to you. You don't feel that cost. But if I were to tell you that suddenly your car, which is not that great, became a classic, and it's now worth $200,000, every time you drive that car around, you're going to realize how much that costs you not to sell it. The opportunity cost suddenly begins to come shining through to you at that point. So we just don't think about the cost until that cost begins to slap us across the face. Ownership creates a cost. So now I can divide equity up in several ways. One way that's pretty typical would be there's preferred stock, and there is common stock. And there's a formula for each of these. For heaven's sakes, don't sweat it. You see the formula, you pick the numbers out of the word problem and put them into the formula, and you get your answer and you move on with your life. There's another way of thinking about equity as well. There is internally generated equity. Internally generated equity, and then there is externally generated equity. Now, internally generated equity is this really weird thing. It's when a company actually earns money. Literally, that's what internally generated equity is. You could call it profit. You could call the accumulation of it retained earnings. Whatever you want, those are really not good terms for it. But internally generated equity is the company that is the money that the company makes on its own, that it can use to pay bills, to run the operation, to grow the company. It's that old-fashioned way of raising money. You earn it through your operations. Now, I caution you that a very sloppy term for internally generated equity is to call it retained earnings. There's an old story about that, comes from the corporate world. This company had a meeting of its executives, and they brought in a couple of the junior executives, and they were talking about how they were going to, they had this new project and how they were going to finance it. And one of the junior executives, come out of a good college, said, well, we should pay for it through retained earnings. And the CFO said, I need you right now to go down to the treasury office here at the company and find the checkbook that is retained earnings. Find that checkbook and bring it up. Make sure that it says retained earnings on each of the checks. And he said, well, I don't think there's one like that. He said, that's right. There's no such thing as retained earnings. There really isn't. It's a bookkeeping thing. Retained earnings is just a number that we record in a book as we accumulate profit. Retained earnings at the beginning plus net income minus dividends, retained earnings at the end. That number builds over time, but that has nothing to do with how much actual money or capital we have that from which we can write checks. It really doesn't. But at the same time, it is used as a sloppy term for internally generated equity, retained earnings. Okay, so now, externally generated equity is when you sell new stock. You raise money by doing an IPO. By the way, I think I've said this before. A company can do an IPO. That's its first time it raises money by selling stock in a public offering. But companies sell stock after that, too. We call those seasoned offerings. Seasoned offerings. I mean, corporations do seasoned offerings all the time. As a matter of fact, some companies even do something called a shelf registration. They'll actually register with the SEC this massive amount of stock. But then they'll put most of it on a shelf, kind of theoretically, and when they need externally generated equity, they'll just pull some of it off and sell it. It's a seasoned offering. But anyway, externally generated equity is just raising capital by selling stock to the public or to the private. Now, if a company's private, it can sell stock through private placements. That's externally generated equity. It's just that stock doesn't trade on a public exchange, and you have to follow some very tight rules for doing that, too. If I have a chance, I'll tell you a little bit about how to do private offerings. But anyway, preferred stock, we usually write the cost of preferred stock as an R sub PS. Now, internally generated equity, we usually write that as an R sub S. And externally generated equity, we write as an R sub N. And I will do the preferred stock. I mean, these are easy formulas. They're just, all I do is take a formula you've already seen and turn it around to get a cost. Now, I'll do the R sub PS, real fast formula. R sub S is a little more involved, but it's just formulas. The R sub N I will save for Wednesday. And I will tell you a story from my consulting days. I don't think I've told you the story, the Made in America story about the drug deals and the pilot. Okay, I'll tell you that, and that'll give me my launch for R sub N. One of my best stories, one that almost got me in terrible trouble, too. But okay, R sub PS. There was a formula. You remember that formula for the price of preferred stock? Remember, the preferred stock has a constant forever dividend. The price right now of preferred stock, that zero means now, was the constant dividend over the cost of the preferred. So, CTT, 1.5% preferred. Par value. $50 per share. So that would mean that the dividend on it, a permanent forever dividend every year, would be 1.5% of $50, which would be 75 cent dividend check per share forever. That's why I've always said that this is kind of a desirable fixed investment for older people, because they're just going to get the same dividend every year forever. Now, the problem is, of course, inflation will erode that over time, but taking that aside. So, if RCPS is, let's say right now, 1.4%, then the price of the preferred stock should be 75 cents per share divided by 0.014. I did that on a calculator real quick here, not trusting my own. 0.75 divided by 0.014. It should sell a little premium. Yeah, 53.57. That, I showed you that before. This is kind of review. Well, we can turn that formula around and say that the cost of preferred stock is that flat dividend divided by the current price of preferred stock. There it is right there. Yeah, all you do is you just say the dividend divided by the current price of the preferred stock. It's not hard at all. Just take the word numbers out of the word question and put it in there, and you've got your price of preferred. Nothing hard about that one. Now, the price of preferred, I'm sorry, the cost of preferred stock, that D over price, current price, that should be a relatively low percentage. It's not usually that much more than the cost of debt. It's cheap stuff. And that kind of leads to the question, well, why don't companies use it hardly at all anymore? It's kind of more complicated than I thought it was. I heard some stories about companies, they don't like preferred because they're married to a required dividend. They can't decide what the dividend is. It's just there forever paying that dividend. And companies don't like that kind of permanent commitment and all that. But it is a pretty cheap. Don't be surprised if you see the price of preferred not very much bigger than the yield to maturity on their debt. Now, equity, common equity. Common equity, I'll do the internally generated equity today. The thing about common equity is it is expensive as hell. I mean, it is expensive. So why don't companies just use debt? Well, that was a big question, a challenge question in finance years ago. If debt is cheaper than equity, why would you ever see a company have common stock? It works like this. Debt is generally cheaper than equity. We start with that. That's a given. However, it gets more expensive the more of it you gather. I'll give you an example from my own company. Every year I do a borrowing. It's a revolving line of credit. A lot of companies do this. You borrow money at the beginning of a cycle, the yearly cycle of your company. And that pays for your stuff through the lean months. And then for my company, as I do the art shows and exhibitions through the spring, summer, and fall, I pay that down until I pay it off. And then I'm ready to go for the next year again. Furniture stores do this. Auto dealerships do this. Boat dealerships do it. A lot of companies, it's called, the big term that's used, or it used to be used, it's called floor plan. You borrow money to get all this stuff on the floor, and then through the year, you sell it and pay off your debt. And I do the same thing every year. Now, let me give you, in my own company, from my own numbers for the current year. They said, okay, the first $5,000 that you use on your line of credit will cost 8.99%. Okay. Then from $5,000 up to, I'm thinking it's $10,000. I said it was $15,000 in the last class, but the more I think about it, I think it's $10,000. It's 12.99%. And anything you borrow above $15,000, they will charge me a whopping 20%, right on the 20.00%. They're charging me more simply because the risk of that marginal dollar that I borrow is going up. I might not be able to pay it back. If I'm borrowing that much money, I might not be able to pay it back. So that default premium in that thing I showed you goes up. And that's the way it is with all corporations. The more they borrow, the higher the coupon. You're going to see that their senior debt has a coupon of, let's say, 4%. The junior subordinated debt has coupons that are all, yeah, like, yeehaw, God, that's an expensive. And it's simply because the risk of default goes up the more debt the company is has on its books that it has to pay those interest expenses payments on. So debt eventually, if you get too much of it in the capital structure, it gets as expensive as equity gets. Equity starts out being much more expensive than debt. But as a company tilts its capital structure toward debt and away from equity, the cost of debt starts to go up. And there is a sweet spot where the cost of the two is about the same. Now, you don't have to know this right now, but I'll tell it to you as a formal definition later. That place where the cost of all overall your capital is at its lowest is called the optimal capital structure. Companies really bust their butts to know what it is and to keep that in place so that equity and debt stay at about the same proportions of overall total capital structure. It's a big thing. As a matter of fact, some companies will even say, well, we're issuing common stock to rebalance our optimal capital structure, to get our capital structure back in line with optimal. Sometimes they'll borrow money, not because they really need money as much as they need to get their debt up because the debt is too much cheaper than the equity. So they can lower their overall weighted average cost of capital by borrowing debt and buying back some of their equity with it, something like that. But anyway, that's for another lecture. Right now, just know that in general, equity is going to be a lot more expensive than debt. You see the yield to maturity on their debt at 8%, 8.15%, something like that. Guarantee you the cost of equity is probably going to be up there around 15-20%. And it's even worse with new equity, which is even more expensive than your existing common shareholders are to you. And yes, that's what we're doing here. That R sub S, that's the cost of your existing shareholders. What they actually cost you. They are a cost. Ownership creates a cost for a corporation because it has to feed those owners. You see that R sub S there? There are actually three ways you can get it. I will be as clear as I can on a quiz or an exam, and I'll have a quiz later this week on Friday, but it won't have this in it. But I'll be clear about which one you should use. You'll tell by the numbers I'm giving you. But how can you find the cost of common stock? The three ways. One way is straight through the capital asset pricing model. Remember, the expected return to a security is the risk-free rate plus the beta of the security times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. That's the old CAPM. You just tell me the risk-free rate. Well, let's get it off a one-year T-bill. Tell me the expected return to the market. There are services that give it right now. We'd say the expected return to the market is maybe about 10%, something like that. And you find the beta of the stock. And then you can just get your cost of common equity. That's that thing right there. Now, obviously, you would say, okay, I'm going to use this because he gave us the beta. And expect a return to the market and the risk-free rate. Problem with this is the beta. What happens if you got a stock that doesn't have a beta yet? It's too young, or it's a private company. Private companies wouldn't have betas. Now, you could go and use comps, find public companies with betas that are like this company, find the average of those betas, but that's kind of taking a shot in the dark. And the expected return to the market portfolio, well, excuse me, different experts are going to give you different answers for that. We try to give it as close as we can. I told you there are services that poll experts in the field. What do you think the expected return to the market is? And they take an average of those. I'm in one of those groups. But that's CAPM. There's another way, there's a second way to do it. Do you remember that formula I showed you for finding a constant growth? The price, current price of common stock would be D1 over R minus G. You remember that thing where the D1 is the current dividend grown one period like that? And I even use that for the horizon value. We just keep using it for different things. That's the constant growth dividend model. Well, if I rearrange that formula, puts the R minus G over here, and then add G to both sides, there's the cost of common stock. So if you're going to do it that way, all you do is take the dividend one period out and divide it by the current price of the common stock. Oops. Can't write. Plus G. You would use this for old established companies where they've got a constant growth rate of the dividends and all that. It is useful to us because it shows us some insights into overall cost of equity. Notice something, that as the price of the stock falls, the cost of equity goes up. There were more than a few meetings, board of directors, executive meetings, when I was a consultant, where I would mention, well, the price of our stock is falling. And I'd usually get this kind of like, well, why is that our problem? And at first, you don't see it as a problem. It's sort of like a little fever. You don't notice it. But as time goes on, that cost of equity going up begins to wear on the company, especially if they decide that they need to raise more capital through common stock. The price of the stock used to be $15. So now that they need to sell some stock to raise capital, it's $10. Suddenly, it hits home to them that the cost of equity capital has gone up for them. They're not getting as much per share as they used to. And then there's another thing in there. Do you notice that the faster company grows, the higher its cost of equity is? See, if G goes up, the cost of common equity goes up. The cost of your owners goes up as the company grows faster. That seems almost counterintuitive, but it's not. Because as the company is growing faster, it has greater risk. The fast growth period of a company is the riskiest part. And that means that the return that the stockholders would want is at its riskiest in a company that's growing rapidly. So this kind of tells us a few things about what are the dynamics behind the cost of equity. Now, there's one other way. And truth be told, this is the one that I've seen the most in actual real companies. And it's the easiest one of all. It says that the cost of equity is going to be the bond yield, the R sub D, plus an equity risk premium. Let me explain. I mean, one thing that would be clear is that we would know the cost of the company's debt. I mean, it's going to borrow money. We'll see what the interest it's paying or the yield of maturity is. What you would do is you would look at a bunch of companies of similar risk. What are their bond yields? So let's say the average bond yield for companies like this company is, I don't know, let's say 8%, okay? And we would go to like Standard & Poor's or someplace like that and look at their cost of equity. The average cost of common equity is right now, let's say, 17% for a bunch of companies that are like this company. Well, that would mean that the equity risk premium is 9% for a typical company. In other words, the extra cost of equity over debt for many companies that are like this one is 9%. So then we can say, okay, what is this company? This company has a cost of debt of, let's say, 9.5%. So all I do is put that on it, that risk premium, which is 9%, and I would get the cost of equity is 18.5%. You just add that premium. So in other words, you would know very well that I was looking for to use that third formula, if I said the equity risk premium is averaging and this company's bonds are right now yielding, and so you just take the company's bond yield right now on its most expensive debt and you'd add the risk premium to it. Like I said, this is the one that I've seen being used the most out there. Some companies like to use that CAPM. You know, it's theoretically clean and secure. And there are some companies, older companies, that use the dividend growth model. It's more likely to be used for modeling new companies or prospective investments. You might use too. But in real world practice, I mean, there are even services that show risk, the equity risk premium for all kinds of different risk classes of companies. So that's the one that's the most popular. But there are three different ways right there that you can find the cost, the current cost of common equity. Here's the upshot. Like I said, equity is quite expensive. There's always that question, why do companies use stock, raise money through stock offerings instead of through debt? The answer would usually be, well, that would mean that they've pushed their borrowings to the point where they can't do any more. It's gotten too expensive to borrow more money. A good example of that would be Netflix. Netflix issued a pile of junk bonds a couple of years ago. Why are they junk bonds? Because the coupon on those was ridiculously high, which tells us that Netflix is at the limit of what it can use as far as debt. Debt is no longer cheaper than equity. When you get the bonds that are yielding as high as that coupon was, that means that equity is actually getting to be very attractive. It will be. So you might anticipate that if Netflix needs more money in the near future, it's probably going to raise it through a seasoned offering of stock. It will not do it through more debt, because the markets have said, we're going to charge you out the wazoo for what we just lent you a couple of years ago, cupcakes. So you might want to go out there and sell some stock to suckers right now. That's just a reality of it. Now, as a last comment on this, this is the whole mess. There's not much more to it except for the cost of new equity. The cost of new equity is more than the cost of your existing shareholders. It's going to cost you more to bring in new owners. It's just like anything in this life. If you want to bring in a new friend, you're going to have to spend money on that friend. If you want to do anything that brings in a new, it's going to cost you more than what you've got now. Almost always it will. That's just the reality of it. In terms of externally generated equity, where does the extra cost come from? It's the fact that, let's say that the current stock price is $50. If you look at equation two, you'd have the dividend one period out divided by $50 plus the growth rate. Okay, no big thing. The problem is that when you sell new stock, you aren't going to get $50 a share. Even if you say the price is $50 a share, just like the stock that's already out there, the investment bankers are going to take their scratch out of it. You're not going to get 50. You're going to get 40, 46, 45, something like that. In other words, the P that you get down there in the denominator for R sub N, new equity, is going to be smaller than the P that is there for your existing shareholders, which means that the equation is going to create a larger number. I'm going to give you an example of that in the practice that I did in rainmaking years ago. It's called the flotation cost, and it makes new equity much more expensive than existing equity. This is the way to ruin companies that just keep selling new common stock. Well, the investment bankers are going to say, yeah, sure, we'll help you out. They'll collect their money to do boilerplates, file with the SEC, do the advertisements and all that kind of stuff, print out the prospectuses, and they'll keep their part of it. So every time a company sells new common stock, it's going to be more expensive than the existing shareholders are. And like I said, I will give you an example of how dramatic that can be in the lecture on Wednesday. Now, I'll probably give you a quiz on Wednesday or Friday. It will be one of those days, probably on Friday. And so eat your Wheaties and get ready for it. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.